the hardest scenes to process are death investigations, whether they are a death by homicide or a death that's natural or suicide or undetermined.
Go law enforcement.
Go law enforcement.
Go law enforcement.
Go law enforcement. The podcast that makes your law enforcement dreams happen.
Welcome to the Go Law Enforcement Podcast, brought to you by GoLawEnforcement.com. I'm your host, Joe Lebowski. If you're looking for a job in law enforcement, GoLawEnforcement.com features the largest listing of law enforcement job openings. Check out GoLawEnforcement.com. Crime scene investigation shows are extremely popular these days. Joanna Hollenbeck is an investigator with the Forensic Services Unit in the Madison Police Department. In this episode of the Go Law Enforcement Podcast, Investigator Hollenbeck discusses the work she and her unit does processing crime scenes, including death investigations.
My name is Joanna Hollenbeck. I am an investigator in the Forensic Services Unit of the Madison Police Department. I am a police officer. It's a promoted position. And I do crime scene processing. I have been with the police department there in Madison for almost 10 years. What we are tasked with in our unit is we deal with assisting patrol and documenting their scenes, whether it's a low-level scene where you have a case of battery and somebody's being arrested for having battered someone else, and they need the injuries documented by photograph, then I respond to those calls and I take photos of that victim of their injuries to be later used in their case if necessary. We process large scenes. So if we have, for example, a homicide, then we go to those scenes. We document with photography, with video. We diagram the scenes. We collect the evidence in conjunction with working with detectives and oftentimes the violent crimes unit. So we have a set of skills where we are helping you manage your evidence to give you the strongest case, whether you're a beat officer on patrol, where it's something that you make the physical arrest that day and you need documentation of damage or injury or a fatal crash, or you have this huge major case where you have multiple fatalities and we need the whole scene documented and maybe we need to request mutual aid from State Patrol because we have a fatal crash. Our job is to deal with evidence and the proper handling and maintaining chain of custody of that evidence in order to build a case. There are some agencies that have crime scene investigators that are civilians. They're trained to do it, but they are civilians that come in, obtain that training, and they come in to do your scene processing only. And it may be that that agency also has an in-house forensics lab where they will also do their own analysis. So for us, we can come in and process a scene, we can collect that evidence, but we're not forensic scientists where we run our own DNA analysis. We have to send that off to an actual scientific lab, which for us is the Wisconsin State Crime Lab. We are responsible for collecting and properly handling and packaging that. But if there needs to be further, for example, like trace analysis, like when you have a scene or you're wanting to collect like small fibers or whatnot that might pertain or give you a lead on who may have done this, committed this crime, then we would want to collect that. But in order to do like the comparison or to look at that and do that comparison or analyze what's in that specific item, it has to be done in a scientific lab. So us as investigators at my agency, we collect the evidence, but then it would be shipped off to the actual scientists to do that analysis because we're also still commissioned police officers. So I still have all the same authority as a police officer because I am a police officer, but I'm a promoted rank. So my job now has become dealing with the scene and evidence. As opposed to, I'm not interviewing people anymore. I don't write up the PC or the charges. That's done by a detective or an officer. I'm dealing with just your evidence in my position. Part of what our job entails is we go into these scenes and sometimes they're very graphic in nature. They're always tragic because, especially when it's a homicide, because somebody has clearly lost their life. And our job is to document that scene to provide the best picture of what happened based on the evidence we're seeing and what the scene looks like when we arrive. We had 3 homicides in 8 days. And one of the calls that I ended up on was a homicide on the south side of the city late at night. We had two victims shot at a gas station. One passed away at the scene, and the other fortunately survived. But it was a large scene. You had an outdoor scene because one victim was shot outside by the gas pumps. The other victim went down inside the store. You had lots of damage. You had broken glass and blood and evidence and vehicles. The only reason I ended up on that call was because I happened to have overtime on my shift. I had a late weapons offense come in at just after 10 that took me a little over an hour to work. And so I got back downtown and I was overlapping with the night investigator. So we just happened to chit chat as I was wrapping up my things when the alert tones went off. And all of a sudden we kind of paused. It's just kind of that natural pause you do as a cop when you hear your weapons tones go off. Everyone pauses to listen. What is this and where is this? And it was evident from the radio traffic right away that we had two victims on scene. And the night investigator turns to me and says, I hope you weren't planning on leaving because I'm going to need help. If we are able to, with staffing, because there are so few of us, and oftentimes there might only be one or two of us, we do prefer to work a homicide in particular with two people. It just helps divide the work and we make sure we don't miss anything and we are able to help each other. So I stayed on then, and he and I went to the scene and began working that scene. And, you know, it's challenging because we have a job to do, but we have to work around this body that we have in our scene. And when you have a scene, especially one like that, where you have some things inside, there are some things outside, family starts showing up. You have lots of officers on scene that are helping manage the perimeter and security and trying to manage all these emotions. I still have a job to do, but you spend a lot of time in those areas where there's things that normal people don't ever want to have to see, nor should they. And you have a job to do. So we're very methodical with what we do. And it was an interesting case because not only did we have all this work to do to document the scene, I got home up just before 7 a.m. in the morning. So I had started at 3 p.m. the previous day. I got done with work about 5:45 a.m., drove an hour home, slept about 4 hours, and had to come back and be back by noon because I was also attending the autopsy. And when we go to the autopsies, we are dressed in scrubs with the forensic pathologist and the morgue tech. And we are in the room as they're doing that procedure because any evidence collected from the body is turned over to us and we start that chain of custody. So we are actually present physically in the room or the surgery suite while the procedure is going on. When they start their exam, that's the autopsy itself, is this whole procedure of documentation, of swabbing, of cleaning the body, and then actually going into the body to locate items and then documenting what is damaged, what organs are damaged, the path of travel of the bullet, what all that bullet hit as it traveled through the body. And when they get to the point where they are removing that bullet from the body, they turn that over to an investigator and we take custody of it. So we will typically, from an autopsy, collect any foreign object from the body. We will collect any and all swabs that the doctor did of the body, and we will collect all of the clothing that the person may have been wearing when they were shot. So all of those pieces of evidence are turned over to us at the autopsy. It was a great learning opportunity, and it was a case where we ultimately were able to identify suspects and they were convicted. So it was a really satisfying feeling to know that you played a part in making sure that that happened for the victims' families. One of the challenges that we find in forensics working in our unit is that we are constantly working against what people see on television and what they think is forensics or what they think can be done. And some of those things are made up for TV. And so we're constantly having to educate that actually isn't the case. We need to do this, this or that, and trying to educate as we go. So with some of the challenges that we have is that, for example, can we swab this for DNA? Well, we can, but depending on the nature of the contact, you know, so if you think a suspect broke into this house, it's a burglary, drawers have gone through, a family comes home from vacation, they see that this is the case, they call us, we come and clear the house, no one's there anymore, but they have stuff missing and things have clearly been gone through. It's difficult in real life to ascertain what may be good areas to swab for potential touch DNA. And the reason is that when you go to swab an area, for me, it depends on the texture of the surface. So in this example, the texture of the surface matters, because the rougher the texture, the better the chances that they're going to slough off cells on that item. But it also is dependent on the time of contact. Quite frankly, like even in an armed robbery at a gas station where maybe the suspect doesn't wear gloves and they grab, say, the forearm and it's skin to skin contact. Maybe they see the clerk going to reach for a phone and they grab their wrist and like, don't do that. You can't do it. And they let go right away after they deter them and then they get the money and they leave. That's a situation where we may swab the person's wrist if they made sure not to cross-contaminate it by touching it again. But the nature of the contact, we may not get enough skin cells to give a full profile when it's analyzed down the road. So that's one of the misconceptions, is that if you swab for touch DNA, that you always get enough to ID who that person is. And that's not the case. The other problem with that is if it's an item that is handled by many, many people, then anything you may get back may be diluted. So that, again, you won't have enough to get a full profile to match anybody that might be in any system that we're able to check. So that's one of the misconceptions, is that like, well, you can get it anywhere. Not all the time. Sometimes there's just not enough there that is detectable once the sample is sent for analysis. So that's one of the things. Same things with fingerprints. Fingerprints are great ways to identify suspects, but depending on the surface might not be a great surface that's going to pick up those oils from the skin to leave that latent print there in order for us to lift it. So those are two things that kind of come up somewhat regularly when we are called to a scene to assist with documenting whatever was located at that scene. Like, can we do this? I mean, we could even throw fingerprint dust on a dresser drawer that clearly was pulled out, and the homeowner's saying, all these drawers were shut when I left overnight, and now they're all pulled out, and I can dust them, and there'll be nothing there. A partial might end up being the homeowner's, because we would want to collect their prints for elimination purposes to show, okay, well, this print is the homeowner's. Are any of these other prints foreign, if any? So some of those things are dependent on how long the item is handled. And it's just brushing by is rarely, if ever, going to leave enough of a latent print or DNA skin cells to identify the person, unfortunately. There are times when we are the bearers of the bad news where, unfortunately, this may come back with nothing. There may not be enough there or anything that shows up when it's taken to the crime lab. So that's one of the big things that we run into. And then we're always trying to strike that balance with, when we're collecting evidence at a scene, what is the forensic value of that evidence? Is it direct evidence that, like, these are fired cartridge cases that show that a gun was fired? Yes, we absolutely would always collect fired cartridge cases, but it doesn't necessarily show specifically where the shooter was standing. And the reason for that is those cartridge cases, when they're ejected, for example, from a semi-automatic handgun, they eject to the right. But if you're standing by a wall or a chair or any item that can bounce that shell off from it, where it lands could be anywhere in that room, or if you're in a vehicle. So there are a lot of things that, yes, they can show that a gun was fired in this general area, but we can't speak with certainty that the person was standing 3 feet left of this pile of cartridge cases. Not with any degree of absolute certainty can we say that. So it gives us leads and gives us ideas, and then we can go back. So I'm looking at a scene that I have and I process that. I want to make sure I'm consulting with the detective, because they're gathering the information about, from either the witnesses or the surviving victims. The victims are describing what happened in this room that I am now standing in and trying to document. And does what I am seeing corroborate what they are saying, or are they contradicting? And we want to communicate that information back and forth, where I'm like, if they said they were shot in the bedroom, I only have cartridge cases in the kitchen. What happened in the kitchen? Can you go back and ask them? Because unless they got carried from one room to another after they were shot, that doesn't match up with what I'm seeing. So it's like you're working this puzzle where you may or may not have all the pieces, but you're trying to complete the picture as fully as you can, knowing that at the end of the day, we may never know with 100% certainty that what picture we're looking at is exactly what happened. Because We all know human recall can vary. They may forget details of the incident because it was so quick or it was so violent or they got knocked out or what have you. There are a variety of reasons, not just because people want to lie. It's just they may not recall exactly what happened, when it happened, and how it happened. So I'm trying to look at that scene and interpret, okay, it looks like the disturbance happened in this room. The altercation happened here. Why do I think that? I have blood here. I have fired cartridge cases here. The gun is right here. Okay, I have this information. I go back to my detective. What are you being told? And then as we say, as he or she gets back to me and says, A, B, and C happened in that room. And I'm like, that makes sense with what I'm seeing. So then I'm wanting to make sure I document everything as I see it. I collect it. I diagram where things are located so that we have those things that work together in a complementary fashion to paint that picture for down the road when that jury hears this case to ultimately decide if the DA is proven beyond a reasonable doubt that this person committed that crime on that day in this place. And so it's this constant problem solving as you're trying to answer these questions. And is that the evidence we have, or did we miss evidence? Is there something else? Was there blood somewhere that we missed or we didn't see or that they tried to clean up that we need to go back and revisit and look for? It's this ongoing process of trying to build your case and making sure that you find any evidence that is to be had and that you're handling it and collecting it appropriately and maintaining that chain of custody as to not contaminate your evidence because you want it to be the best and strongest possible as that case moves forward. I would say the hardest scenes to process, just in a very general way, are death investigations, whether they are a death by homicide or a death that's natural or suicide or undetermined. And I think what adds to the level of challenge is, for example, if you have a suicide where perhaps the person was discovered by a friend or family member. And then by the time I get there to assist in documenting that scene, you have a gathering of friends who are highly emotional or family. And I have a job to do and I can do that job. And patrol officers have their jobs to do and they're assisting with scene security or interviewing people and trying to get background information. But when you have all those emotions of those people that are physically there, either in or near your scene, you know, maybe we have them in the front yard because the scene is in the kitchen and we need to have the house clear so that we can do the processing. Those are really hard because they're so emotional and you know that I have a job to do to document, but these people that are outside clearly upset, they have lost someone very near and dear to them. And sometimes it's a shock, sometimes it's expected, sometimes it's a medical event, but I don't think anyone's ever really prepared for a death when it happens, regardless of the circumstances. There's always a level of shock. So those scenes are really, really challenging. And I think when you have deaths that involve children, those are by far the hardest cases to work. Because even if you're not a parent, to see something like that is incredibly challenging. And sometimes me as an investigator, I have to be in that scene with that body for several hours. As investigators, we see terrible things, because we have the responsibility and the job of going in to process those scenes. So that's part of what we have to do. And we have to do it appropriately. We have to be efficient and thorough, but we are exposed to a lot of traumatic things. I would say in terms of other challenging processing, when you have an outdoor scene in poor weather. So if you have an outdoor scene in the winter or when it's raining, and your chance for you to potentially lose any sort of biological evidence, or if you have a large scene. We had a house explosion in September of 2017 that was ultimately done to cover up a homicide. And then you have this vast multi-level scene that's unstable because there was fire, and you might not even be able to work that scene until 1 or 2 or 3 days into it. And then it's a multi-agency endeavor. They're very interesting and you learn a ton, but they're very challenging because it's like finding that proverbial needle in a haystack, especially in an explosion type scene where you have to sift through literal rubble of what's left of that house to find the victim. Do we have the weapon? Is that in there? It can be really daunting at times to be dealing with these large scale scenes. So we have a homicide. I'm en route to the scene. I'm working by myself. So I'm going to be the only one there, at least for the time being. I have relief coming to assist me, but it's going to be at least an hour. I'm going to get started. When I get to that scene, I want the scene supervisor, or if there's already a scene detective there, I want them to walk me through what my scene looks like. I might see the body right away because it's right there covered with a blanket, but what all are we determining to be the scene? Are there any fired cartridge cases? Is there a knife? Is there a weapon of some sort? Where did the suspect go? Is there a path of travel? I want to know what they know when I get there. So typically the call will come out. I might get requested anywhere from 20 minutes to 40 minutes after the call has started for me to start heading out to that scene because they have to stabilize the scene, make it safe, and then they call me in. So I want that walkthrough first. They're going to show me what we have. They have any pieces of evidence that have been located. An officer will be standing by because they are the guardian of that evidence until I take over. And I want to know where everything is. Once I know the parameters of what I'm looking at, where my boundaries are, where we think the evidence has ended, and then I'm going to go back and I'm going to start first with photography. And we always start with photography because we want to freeze that scene as best we can with what it looks like when I arrive. And I know that I will never have a pristine scene because if we have a scene and it's a shooting and ends up being a homicide, the first officer on scene that gets there, that is the first person to lay eyes on it, they have the mental snapshot of what that perfect scene looked like. But then the moment they start to render aid, which is what they should do once they know there's not a threat nearby to themselves or to the victim, my scene has now been changed. It's been altered out of necessity, but it's been altered. So by the time I get there, I know there have been changes to that original scene that were necessary, but I need to freeze that scene. So now everyone needs to be out of my scene so I can document it as is at this moment right now. And so then I take a series of photographs documenting wide overall shots, medium, and coming in and taking close-up shots of anything of note or of evidentiary value. Once I complete all of the photography, if I have a deceased person, then my next step is to go and I get my video camera and I'm going to do a walkthrough video of the scene. So I will start my video camera at my truck and come through and do a slow walking tour of everything that's visible on the scene. And that's just to provide a different lens, a moving lens of what is there. You know, they're kind of bouncy. There's no sound. It's just to provide an additional layer of visual documentation to that scene. Once I get done with that, I go back and if there's any new information that my scene detective has available to me, they'll share that with me or I'll ask for it. And we go around and start marking with those little yellow placards that you have seen on lots of crime scene shows, the evidence that we want marked in a diagram, that we want documented the location where it is right now in relation to the body or the scene or the car or what have you. We go and mark all of those. And then once I have everything marked that has been located, usually in consultation with the detective, I'll go back through and do an additional set of photos of all the evidence marked with the placard. And that's just for me to keep things organized because I'll do a written report after I'm done with all of this. And once I have everything documented, then I'm going to do a sketch. It's going to be a rough sketch, but I'm going to be taking measurements with the assistance usually of, I can have anyone help me because they only need to hold a tape measure. And I am marking down distances from points of reference in the scene, whether that's a wall or a doorway or a light pole or a curb edge if we're outside. And I want to document specifically where those things marked by placards may be in my scene. And that can take a lot of time. I mean, you can have a scene where you have 30 articles marked outside and I want to measure all of it. And it's only until after all of that is done that I will then work with that detective to go through and we figure out what are we going to collect out of this scene. Because I might have, say, broken glass, like this person was shot standing outside their car and there's vehicle glass on the ground. And I'll put a placard by it because it's of note. It happened during this incident, but I wouldn't necessarily collect that glass. Not unless we determine that there's a forensic value to having that glass. So I might not collect an item marked by every placard, but we'll end up collecting the majority of it. And so then it's methodically going through, changing your gloves between each article, bagging it up, labeling it, and then securing it in your truck. And then once all of that is done, checking in with someone from the command post, is there anything else of note that I need to be aware of here before I leave the scene with my evidence to go back downtown and secure it and begin working on additional follow-up I need to do on this case. So it's very methodical, but it boils down to take your photos, take a video if necessary after the photos, measure and identify and measure your evidence, complete the diagram, and then collect that and appropriately package it when you are able. And that's what we do on, you know, I go to a call for battery photos. All they need are the photos. I don't have to do those other steps. I'm literally just going to that scene to confer with the officer briefly, meet the victim, document their injuries with photographs, and I end my contact. I don't have to do all the other things because I'm only needed for the one specific task on that simple scene. On a scene where we have, say it's a homicide and we have a body on scene that is not transported because they had non-survivable injuries and they died at the scene, that body is one of the biggest pieces of our evidence. It is our most important piece of evidence. So we have an officer stand by literally next to that body. You know, it'll be covered if we're outside, but they'll stand by. But we don't search through anything on the body until our forensic pathologist arrives on scene to go through them, because that person, that physician, our forensic pathologist, they want the body as is at the time of death. So, you know, there have been times when I've been on calls like that where you hear a phone ringing. We're not going to disturb any of that until it has been documented with photography and our doctor and the medical examiner's office have been there to do their exam. And then depending on the nature of the case and why we think this shooting may have happened, there are some things that once that search of the body commences, it's going to be the doctor that does that search and say we think it's related to maybe a drug deal that went bad. They'll turn that phone over to us immediately, which will then go to a detective or myself to take into custody because we might want to dump that phone at some point after we have the time to do so and get it back to our digital forensics people. But we won't search that body for anything of a decedent until we have the doctor with us. And then any personal effects like jewelry or whatnot, the medical examiner keeps custody of, but anything that might be evidentiary value related to the crime would be turned over to us as part of our chain of custody with that. I think in order for you to want to do the type of worker you would be processing a crime scene, either as an evidence technician, as a civilian, or as an investigator, like what I do as a police officer in my agency, you have to be able to deal with seeing a lot of terrible things. And I find it a little bit ironic because as police officers, even a patrol officer, we all have those calls, especially the longer you do the job. You have a death investigation, you have a fatal crash, you have all these things you go to. But what's different about what I do versus what patrol does is patrol has these calls and they may have opportunities to like physically step out of the scene or adjacent to the scene. They don't have to be deeply embedded in the scene to do their work. They can do the interviews in the room adjacent to where the person's body is. Whereas my job requires that I have close personal contact with that deceased person. I may need to assist the medical legal examiner in moving that body. I'm stepping through areas of sometimes bodily tissue or blood in order to take my photos of that person or that scene. So I have a lot of extended contact with really horrible scenes. And so as a civilian, if you were working for an agency that then came in and provided that service to a smaller agency, or you know, you're contracted to do that in this big city or what have you, you have to be able to manage that. And so if that means that you have outlets to deal with the trauma, because vicarious trauma is a real thing. It's something that we all have and we all deal with, but it can be a daily thing. I think kind of goes in streaks. I had 3 weeks ago, the first 3 days of my rotation, I had a death investigation every day. And you become used to it to a degree. So I think you do well in this job if you have the tolerance, you kind of have a little bit of that macabre fascination in those things. But you're also in close proximity. It's not just looking at a picture. you were in the thick of it. And so if you can look at the photos, but you're like, oh, I don't know if I could be right next to that body for 2 hours, then maybe it's not the best fit for you to go into this particular, because even police officers will tell me, oh, I don't know how you do your job sometimes, because that's a lot to be in there. Because we do, we see a lot of terrible things. And so you have to really understand that and know yourself pretty well to know if you are going to be able to do that for the long term. I would not want another job. I felt like when I started this job, I found what I was meant to do. And I'm going to get emotional. I'm sorry. I'm so proud of the work that we do. And that being said, we at our department, we really value a varied background. So if you are not a criminal justice major, I don't want anyone, male or female, to think that that is going to work against you in getting into law enforcement, if that's something you want to do. I think, especially at Madison, which is one of the reasons I was really drawn toward this agency, is that they really, truly value diversity. I take a lot of pride in the fact that we work really well together. We have a really great team in our unit. And I like playing a role in providing justice to these families by making sure I do all that I can to properly and appropriately document the scene. That's something I want to do every day on every call that I go to.
If you're looking for a job in law enforcement, check out the largest listing of law enforcement jobs on golawenforcement.com. Thanks for listening.